those are the most dangerous situations. Somebody's holding a hostage. They hold a hostage to get something they can't get on their own. So you have to look at what's their goal. Their goal is to get this thing that they want. It's really not in their best interest to kill the hostage because then they know the police are going to come in and kill them. We have an extraordinarily high success rate with hostage situations. People think it's the opposite. The most dangerous, also the most common, but they can lead to be the most dangerous, is...
Hi, I'm Wyatt.
And I'm Grace.
And you're listening to Our Dad and your host of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Moore, and we're back with our Expert Corner interviews. You guys know that have listened to me for a long time. We are very topic-based, and very rarely do we get the opportunity to bring somebody in outside of the vacation rental world, but we've got a very special guest today, and I'm super excited about this conversation we're about to have with Mr. Gary Nestner. Gary is a retired, 30-year retired FBI investigator, instructor, negotiator. Position he retired from was the chief of the FBI's Crisis Negotiation Unit, Critical Incident Response Group, which means he was involved in some pretty intense negotiations. Terrorist embassy takeovers, airplane hijackings, prison riots, overseeing kidnappings, and many, many more, and many of them that you guys have heard of as historic events in the United States. And so Gary has been involved in some very critical negotiations on behalf of all of the citizens of the U.S. So I appreciate that, Gary, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Sean. It's nice to be here with you today.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, Gary, you know, we were talking before we hit record, and I mentioned that as we hit record is most of the time we're talking about real estate investing and short-term rental investing and everything else. And with your background as, you know, in the negotiation space and in critical situations and really being able to keep conversations going, right? It's funny because not that I'm trying to discount the importance of the work that you've done by any stretch, but there's some crossovers on, there's a lot of times when we're negotiating our real estate deals and I say, hey, listen, let's just keep the conversations going. And a lot of your career has been buying time. And, you know, it's even the title of the book we're going to talk about is Stalling for Time a little bit. And so before we get into all the kind of the outlines and negotiations, talk about some of the things that you've learned over the years, I'd love to start with the background. You've got a very, very interesting career and something that most of us have never, you know, thought about doing. You know, we don't a lot of times, you know, think we're going to dive into that. But what got you? Tell me a little bit about the background, where you grew up, what got you interested in that in the first place?
Yeah, I grew up in Atlantic Beach, Florida, near Jacksonville. And, you know, as a young kid, had a great childhood, great parents, neighbors, friends, you know, two blocks from the ocean, you know, really, really nice. You know, I don't have a hardship story of my youth to leverage. But, you know, when I was still in grammar school, I watched this television show about the FBI. And I told my mom, you know, I'd had an epiphany, even if I didn't know what that meant yet. And I wanted to be an FBI agent. And she went out and bought me a book on it. And I read it. And then I was all in. And it just seemed like the most interesting and exciting career to me, chasing gangsters and spies and, you know, the Thompson machine gun, all that sort of stuff that a young man might find alluring. And then, you know, then I eventually achieved my dream after college. I joined the FBI and, you know, negotiations didn't exist then. So I started off doing regular investigative things, bank robberies and fugitives, and transferred from South Carolina, my first office, to Washington. And there I worked foreign counterintelligence for a few years, and then terrorism. And then at the same time, you know, I became a negotiator. I received some information about this, what was then a very new program that the FBI essentially copied from NYPD. And then, and it seemed to suit my personality and what I thought were my strong suit, my attributes, and it did, you know, and it was a sidelight job for me for many years. I'm working overseas hijacking cases, and at the same time, I'm teaching police negotiations and responding to any situations in the territory I worked for the FBI. And then in 1990, I was asked to become one of two full-time negotiators in the FBI, you know, and managing 350 negotiators nationwide. And then a few years later, they created a standalone unit, And I was named the first chief. That happened right after Waco in 93. So I did that, you know, for the remaining 10 years of my career. And it was obviously challenging, rewarding, and, you know, it didn't always have happy endings, but we achieved some pretty significant positive outcomes. You know, we got people to cooperate and avoid violence in about, you know, 92-93% of the cases. And that there's really not much in law enforcement that achieves that kind of outcome. So, you know, a lot of it was based on, you know, the skills that we were teaching and we had learned and refined through the years.
When you talk about some of those, like when you go into those situations, like give us an idea of what a tip, like it's interesting where I didn't know that backstory of the negotiation units were, you know, that department was fairly new. I mean, in you know, you basically saw it grow up and from the very beginning.
Well, the NYPD started its negotiation program, I think, in 73, and the FBI started in 74. But to be honest, the first, you know, 10, 15 years for everybody in law enforcement that embraced the general concept, it was pretty rudimentary stuff. It was basically bargaining. You know, you want a hamburger in there? Fine. Give me one of those hostages and I'll give you a hamburger. But it did achieve more positive results in that instead of just charging in with guns blazing, now we were opening a dialogue and creating a level of trust with the perpetrators. And fortunately for us, in more situations than not, people want to live more than they want to die. They may want to say, I'm willing to die, I don't want to go back to jail, whatever. But in reality, most people, you know, are naturally inclined to want to live. So if we slowed the process down and we tried to avoid an escalation and we opened a dialogue, we were achieving quite significant results. The biggest trend that I feel very proud of and having really spearheaded in the FBI was a move from that bargaining philosophy to a crisis intervention model, you know, using the work of, you know, famed psychotherapist Carl Rogers and using active listening skills to create a relationship of trust. So we found out that, you know, a very high percentage, 90% of the perpetrators that we were dealing with, they really didn't have a concrete goal in mind. They were acting out, you know, their frustration, their rage, their anger, their sense of loss. And instead of showing up and saying, this is Gary with the FBI, come out or we're going to come get you, you know, I'd say, hey, Sean, what's going on in there? You know, I could tell you're having a really difficult day and there's some things that are certainly bothering you and I want to help if I can. I don't want to see you get hurt or anybody else. It's not what people expect from law enforcement. And it's a proverbial foot in the door so we can begin to gain their trust and ultimately their cooperation. You know, it's not to suggest there isn't loss of life in some of these situations, but once we open negotiations, the prognosis for loss of life is minimal. And the primary reason we do it is so we don't have to send police officers into a dangerous situation to get killed. Everybody always said, oh, it's the hostages. Okay, that's great. We're not God. We didn't create this situation that we are responding to, but we want all of our people to go home safe. And if through the negotiations team's efforts, and it's usually a team effort, if we can get cooperation from the perpetrator and not have to put people with guns up against other people with guns, you know, that's a good outcome for us. And, you know, it's very gratifying when people walk away from these things that otherwise might have been seriously injured or killed, and police officers are saved. You know, the National Crisis Negotiation course that I taught at the FBI Academy for many years, we would have police officers attend and in addition to agents, and there would always be a sad story from some police department around the country where they went in and confronted a gunman. And when I would ask them to share the experience with the class, they almost always did. And once you heard the particulars, the overriding question was, why did you go in? You know, it was an artificial deadline. Well, it's cold, it's wet, this son of a gun is jerking us around, we're going to show him who's in charge. And you end up going to a police funeral because of that. And, you know, we have to be wiser, smarter, more careful in not only preserving our lives, but trying to get innocent life and even the perpetrator out. And, you know, it's a very proven methodology. You know, when I first started teaching active listening skills in the FBI in 1990, you could go to any police department in the country and meet with the negotiators and say, how many of you are familiar with active listening skills? And people would have thought you landed from Mars. They would have no idea what you're talking about. Now there's, you know, dozens and dozens of negotiation associations around the country. And if you don't know active listening skills, you're simply not a professional. You're just, yeah. You know, you're behind the eight ball on that stuff. So, I mean, that's kind of it, you know, Sean, and this pertains to your business. I mean, everything in life's a relationship. I mean, everything, whatever, if you're selling widgets or renting vacation homes or, you know, trying to create a business, we are social animals and we need to interact and engage with other people. And if we can avoid conflict or resolve conflict favorably when it does arise and inevitably will, then we stand a better chance in a calmer atmosphere to come to an equitable agreement. As long as our emotions are bursting, our ability to think and behave rationally is extremely low.
Yeah. And it's so interesting when, and congratulations too, by the way, on kind of spearheading that and like seeing it from like, okay, I'll give you this, you give me that, this bargaining to let's just like understand human psychology and what do most people really want? What, you know, we want to be loved and understood. And then, you know, you start to do that with somebody and they always say in sales, people buy from people they know, like, and trust. And that's really ultimately what you're really trying to do. It sounds like with that active listening.
People want to be listened to and they want to be understood. Yep. And when they're acting out, they're holding their girlfriend or their boss or whatever, they're basically saying there is something bothering me and nobody's paying attention. Nobody's listening to me. Nobody understands me. Yep. Nobody appreciates my point of view or how I'm suffering from whatever it is going on. You don't have to agree with them or think that their analysis of the situation is correct. That's irrelevant. You know, you're just saying, I understand. I hear you. And we don't just say we understand. The key part of active listening is we demonstrate it by paraphrasing it in our own words. So let me understand, Sean, you know, this happened to you. And because of this, it had a tremendous effect on you and your family. And you're just crushed. You don't know where to turn. You don't know what to do. You know what the future holds. You know, if I get all of that right when I feed back to you what I have heard you say, then I am very strongly telling you, I heard you and I understand. You know, I'm not saying you're absolutely right. You should go kill somebody. Yeah. No, I'm not going that far, but I'm saying I hear what you're saying, you know, and, you know, I haven't experienced something like that, but I've certainly had challenges in my life and I know how frustrating that can be. And I know how angry you are and you feel as though the hard work you've done is not appreciated. It's just something that people typically do not expect to hear from law enforcement.
Right.
And some of the best police officers, the best interviewers, interrogators, get into the negotiation field because they're very good at this. There's a large component of natural ability plus the training, and it makes it quite an effective combination.
What are some of the natural, like I've heard, you know, when I was getting ready for this interview, obviously listened to a few of your other interviews and a common theme came up about, you know, that you have a natural ability to just stay calm and reasonable, right? There's not like these, you don't like, you know, have like, from what I was reading about, don't have these big peaks and valleys in your emotions, right? You stay very calm in these very tense situations. And I'm sure that has a calming effect on the people you're talking to as well, right? It's like, okay, he's staying in control. I can calm down. Is that one of those natural abilities?
Well, I think you can argue endlessly about nature versus nurture. You know, I mean, how much of this was part of my innate personality or that of any other good negotiator, and how much of it's training? Well, it's both, you know, and I certainly got better at this as I did more and more of it. But, you know, the favorite quote in my book, I put quotes before each chapter, is the partial quote from Rudyard Kipling, which so many people know. And that's if you can keep your head about you when everybody else is losing theirs and blaming you. You know, it's that person, and we all know them in our lives, you know, that no matter what, you know, is going on, what crazy, unexpected, tumultuous things going on, this person remains calm and, you know, and we make better decisions. And the graph I use when I teach is the simplest and most important one. It's a childhood teeter-totter, you know, the playground equipment. Yeah. One kid's up, one kid's down. And if you look at it, that emotions are high, then it is an absolute irrefutable given that rational thinking behavior is low. You can't. When you're exploding mentally and crazy and upset, you're not thinking clearly. So what we try to do as negotiators is not come up with this brilliant solution to solve this person's life problems, but we try to communicate with them in a way that helps them lower their emotions. And look what happens when we do. You know, their ability to think and behave more rationally comes up. It's really quite simple stuff. And all of us should do it, you know, more often in other walks of life. And it requires, you know, controlling your own. I mean, I have my buttons in life, too. There's things that make me frustrated and angry. But, you know, if it's an important critical situation, you know, I do a better job controlling that and purposely modeling for the other person the kind of behavior that I'd like to see in return. People tend to, you know, feedback what they get. So, you know, yeah. I think doing those things, you know, you might have a client that gets very mad at you and, you know, you can get mad back at them and you're being disrespectful and I don't have to put up with that nonsense. Or you can say, man, it sounds like we might have let you down and I'm really, yeah. I'm sorry. And, you know, if you've done something wrong, fine. You know, I can't change that, but I can make it right for you. And here's what I'm going to do. You know, I think, again, somebody wants to be heard. They want to be listened to. They want to be respected. And we're dealing with people, and I think you touched on it before, that typically are experiencing a sense of loss. Loss of career, loss of relationship is very big, loss of self-esteem. And they're angry. And you know, and we have to – those are the most dangerous situations. Somebody's holding a hostage. They hold a hostage to get something they can't get on their own. So you have to look at what's their goal. Their goal is to get this thing that they want. It's really not in their best interest to kill the hostage because then they know the police are going to come in and kill them. We have an extraordinarily high success rate with hostage situations. People think it's the opposite. The most dangerous, also the most common, but they can lead to be the most dangerous, is, you know, the romantic relationship that's gone bad, the controlling husband that won't let his girlfriend leave with the kid or whatever it is, you know, and those are can very quickly turn into homicide followed by suicide. And those are the ones that are the trickiest and the most challenging. But we're also quite successful with those if we undertake the approach that, you know, that sort of touched on already here.
Do you, when you have, for a lack of a better term, an outline of what you're really trying to do, it sounds like it always starts with, hey, listen, we've got to go in, make sure that they feel heard and understood. Like, hey, listen, we're here. I get it. You're frustrated. You know, I've had bad days myself. You're trying to build that trust and to keep that conversation alive. The longer that conversation is live, the more of a relationship you're starting to build, hoping to get that teeter totter to kind of level out and say, hey, listen, let's talk rationally here. I'm not necessarily going to agree with what you're doing, but I want to get you to the point where we can have a conversation. What then is, does it come to when you start to recognize that of your start to reason with them like, hey, here's the multiple outcomes. Do you start giving them outcome options and for them to kind of choose from and walk them through or outline
but,
beyond
you know,
that?
You basically would, you know, a conversation would go something like this. I said, Sean, you know, you've asked me to do a lot of things. You know, you want to get a helicopter and you want to fly out of the country. And I think we both know that's going to be extremely challenging to do. Now, I haven't told you no.
Right.
But in a backhanded sort of way, I've let you know that that's not likely to happen. Or you may be making behaving irrationally and behaving badly or whatever. And I might say, Sean, you know, I'm trying to help you here. Allow me to help you. Help me help you. And what I need to be able to do is go to my boss who makes the decisions and say, hey, you know, Sean is a decent guy. I don't think he wants to hurt those people. I think we can work with him. And what can we do reasonably to get this resolved? You know, what can I do to help address the grievance that you have against your employer or your attorney or whatever it might be. I think you follow that script. I don't, you know, and we ask them to do some problem solving. You know, what is it that you hope to achieve? What sort of outcome do you want? I don't know if I can do that for you, but I'd like to know what it is that you're seeking and see what we might be able to do. And it's also okay. Some negotiators are afraid to say, you know, I can't send you in another gun. I just can't do it, Sean. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things we can do. I can't do that.
That's not one of them.
So let's talk about what we can do together. you know, it's okay to be firm. It's okay. But what we're really trying to do is show that we are respectful. We're genuine. We're sincere. We're not lying to them. You know, you might say, well, if I come out with those people, what's going to happen? Am I going to go to jail? You know, am I going to say, oh, don't worry about it, Sean. Come on out. It's going to be fine. Nothing's going to happen. You know, I'm going to be turned into a fraud very quickly because, you know, that's nonsense. I'm going to say, you know, I'm not a judge. I'm not a jury. I'm sure there will be some charges pressed and you'll have to address those. But, you know, I think you'll find that's the best recourse of action. You haven't hurt anybody yet. And, you know, I'm certainly willing to tell a judge that you were cooperative and came out peacefully, you know, and I think that's your best option. And, you know, that's the kinds of discussions we get into. And the number one thing that a negotiator hopes to portray over a conversation is this thing that's hard to define, but we all know it when we see it. And that's likability, just being a likable, genuine person. Yep. Because I discovered this through trial and error, through many years of doing this, when people would come out and surrender, you know, peacefully. And we'd say, what did we say that made you come out? Because we want to learn, we want to replicate and, you know, and do this in the future. And it's quite surprising, Sean, the answer would almost always be the same. And here's what it was. They'd say, I don't remember what you said, but I like the way you said it. And you think about that for a minute, your tone, your demeanor, your sincere, not fake, demonstration of being understanding, empathic, is a powerful, powerful tool to influence human behavior.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And the reason this is really fascinating to me, just like the dynamics of all this, because it really, like Gary, most of us are never going to be faced in these types of negotiations. Most of us are never going to be trying to talk somebody, you know, off the cliff in a in a very dramatic situation. But a lot of us negotiate on a lot of things throughout our whole lives. And as I'm listening to you kind of talk about this, there is a lot of crossover. As you know, when we're going through a real estate deal, it's like, hey, listen, I got to get, you know, I want to make sure that you know, you hear the cliche term all the time. We're always trying to put together win-win deals, right? And it gets, but at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to do, but it's not, it doesn't have to do with flattery. It doesn't have to do with telling them you're going to do something you're not. It has to be very sincere. There's so many deals that we put together over the years that were just look like no, there's no possible way we're going to come to be able to be both of us get what, you know, the deal that works. And keeping that conversation going, keeping things that are, you know, there. We talk about doing love letters with buyers and sellers, you know, the point of that is to say, hey, listen, I we never go into a deal, for example, and tell them all the things that are wrong with their house so I can get a better deal, right? I say, hey, listen, I'm making you an offer. I love your house. You've done an amazing job with it. Yeah. There's some things that we're probably a little bit far off on meeting on, but we need to, I think we can overcome it and blah, blah, blah. But it's really a lot of what you're talking about is just making sure we're having that conversation. Making sure we say the things that, you know, that we're looking for. And we say that all the time. I'm like, man, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do that, but let's try to figure it out together. Like, let's try to figure out like, you know, how we can put this deal together. When it comes to, cause there's times when we have the conversation on the front end. Hey, what do you need out of this? What are you looking for? You know, I know that you're, you know, beyond price. Let's talk about real estate for a minute. Beyond the asking price that you're asking, you know, tell me the reasons you're selling. What are you looking for? What are the most important things out of the sale for you? Especially when we're way off on price. I start there. And sometimes that conversation drags a while and it doesn't feel like we're going to get to the point where we get to, and it becomes almost like, hey, we're friends now. Right. And let's talk about, we start talking about kids and we start talking about jobs and we start talking about everything else. Yeah. And we're like, I need to get back to the deal somehow. Right. Because, you know, but it's great because we're building this relationship. When I get back to the, not the demands of the deal, but sort of like, what does everybody want out of this? And we're pretty far off. Is there anything that you guys would always think about? Like, would you if I was saying, hey, Gary, I'm in here and I've got all these hostages, you tell me what you'll give me. Or like, and you're not going to list a whole bunch of stuff you're going to give me. I'm guessing you're going to say, hey, listen, Sean, tell me what you want first, right? What are you looking for?
You hit on one thing we don't typically do. We don't ask for demands.
Okay. Yeah. That would be the bargaining side, right?
There's a time for that. Further into the conversation, the dialogue, the number of meetings you have, whatever, you might say, you know, Sean, we've talked about this for a while now, and I think I understand for your position. And it looks like the one troubling issue is the following. And how do you think we might overcome that? What would it take to make you feel more comfortable? That's a lot different than starting out and say, what is it going to take for you to close this deal? It's too soon. Sure. You give them too much power and too much control. And then if it's something you simply can't do, I mean, it's a real impediment to relationship building. So,
you know,
Stephen Covey, the business guru, says it. It's an old philosophical given, but he has a nice way of putting it. He says, first seek to understand and then to be understood. Yeah. So first invest the time in listening to the other person, trying to fully understand what it is they're trying to achieve. You know, people don't always say what they want. You know, the issue might be on the table, might be economics, but it might be something more important. You know, it might be some sort of philosophical issues. You know, it sounds like, you know, you've raised three generations of your family in that home, and you have some blood, sweat, and tears there. And I know that's a really important thing to you. And you know, I think the buyers here really want to preserve that integrity of that home for you. And, you know, here's what we might do to make sure that happens. I don't know. You know, there's a million things you can talk about, but it has to come at the right place. You know, so I guess I got a little far afield there, but relationship first, deal second. You know, and too often in the business context, and we Americans are, and we men more than women, we're just get right to the quick. What's
the right deal? To the deal?
Just what's the deal?
Yeah, deal points.
And
right,
we're much better off stalling for time. Good name of a book. You know, slowing it down and identifying the larger issues before we start to boil it down to its essential components required for a deal to be closed. So think relationship first. Now, we don't purposely elongate a conversation if it's all going properly and everybody's happy. We don't say, oh, not yet, Sean, we got to talk some more, you know, but you know, because we may have an instant connection. And, you know, and sometimes when you're dealing with somebody, you may say, you know, I don't know this person very well, but I like them. There's something about them. They come across as honest. They seem to have integrity. I trust them. You know, I find myself doing that all the time. We moved into a new home less than 2 years ago. And of course, you have to have contractors do various things, you know, and I interview them. And I don't always go with the cheapest one because sometimes I don't get the right vibe back from the person, you know, and somebody else may send better signals to me about the quality of the work, the reliability, their commitment to fix things that go wrong, and they always do. You know, and so there's intangibles there that we have to take into consideration. So, I mean, I don't know how you teach somebody to be likable, but we should all strive you know, and I think you do that by not putting pressure on yourself. You know, you should, I went into every negotiations I ever did thinking I'm going to be victorious. Why? I didn't think I was the greatest negotiator in the world, but I said, I know I'm sincerely going to do everything within my power to help these people come out of this alive. I don't decide the outcome. I can influence it. But ultimately, today, Sean, my adversary, decides the outcome. Now, I'm going to do my best, and I'll probably succeed in helping him find the right path. But I can't guarantee that. You know, so if you don't worry about failing, then you don't get that performance anxiety. And I think in sales, sometimes people put so much pressure on themselves to close the deal that they end up coming across insincere, not genuine. You know, the classic, you know, used car salesman, hey, Sean, I know exactly what you need. You know, well, we're not that close yet, and you don't know what I need yet. We don't have a relationship. It's too soon. It's too quick. You haven't earned the right to be of influence to me. And you have to earn the right by listening and giving me feedback and paraphrasing what I've said and demonstrating to me through your responses that you understand what I'm trying to achieve and what I'd like to see as an outcome. I don't expect you to roll over and do everything I want, but I want you to understand what I'm looking at. You know, and it all sounds so simple, doesn't it? But people don't do it, and they pay the price for it in terms of selling as much as they would want or having the successful business they'd like to have.
Well, I think the key points that I'm just picking up on just overwhelmingly is, listen, it's not that, you know, the we always say, like we talked about, people are going to do business. They're going to work with people that they know, like, and trust, you know, like you said with Stephen Covey, seek first to understand and then to be understood.
Right.
All of that leads naturally to the conclusion, especially if you're authentic in those conversations, authentic and actually wanting to know what somebody else wants in a deal. I think that makes a big difference on the likability.
No.
When you go in and have a conversation and you're just thinking about the next question you're going to ask, instead of listening to what they're telling you on the first question you asked, you know, people pick up on that stuff, right? And
they do.
And that leads to your agenda. Like, just don't have that huge agenda. It's like, listen, let's go in and try to figure this out. And together, maybe we can, maybe we can't. And it's okay. Either way, it's going to naturally lead us to an outcome.
Yeah. And sometimes you just listen, because if you're quiet, you know, as humans interact in conversation, the other party will tend to fill up the dead space by telling you more. And if they're telling you more about what's on their mind or the issues or the concerns or problems or having whatever it is, then the more you can provide feedback to that. So, I mean, the other thing is, you know what? Nobody's going to make 100% of the sales. It's just not going to happen. I mean, everybody's, oh, I've never lost a sale. I'm the world's greatest salesman. Good for you. Good for you. But I've never met one, you know, and it's okay. Just if you go into it saying, I'm sincerely going to try to understand this customer and do the best I can to make an arrangement, a deal, you know, sign the contract, whatever, then you'll be successful most of the time. You know, but knowing that, hey, this person didn't go, but, you know, they had factors going on that I didn't control. You know, their wife's not here and she makes the decisions. Or this guy says he represents his company, but we know the treasurer is going to go with who's the cheapest. So, you know, this doesn't mean you failed, you did anything wrong. It just say, this one got off the hook. So what? Okay. Doesn't stop me from fishing, and doesn't mean I'm not a good fisherman, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And it's not always about, too, on the front end, like closing a deal, closing a sale, doing all that stuff, too. There's sometimes where you use this stuff just in, like, we talk about a lot because we work with a lot of investors. We're buying deals, but we also own properties, and we have people coming in and out of them all the time. Well, you get reviews, and you have customers, and you have customer experiences. And if something goes wrong, you know, or they say they didn't like something about a house, sometimes some people's natural tendency is to get really defensive. What do you mean you don't like my house? What do you mean you didn't like this? I just cleaned it, right? You say it's dirty. I was the one that cleaned it and it was great. Instead, and you said this earlier in our conversation, is we always tell people, listen, agree with them. Say, man, I am so sorry. That is not what we wanted to have happen in our house. Like, you know, we always apologize because their experience was it wasn't great. And that's not what we want. It's true. It's sincere. I'm like, man, I'm really sorry this happened, Gary. You know, I was the last one that cleaned it. I must have missed something. You know, I want to make sure that we get this right for you. And
how can we make it right? Yeah. How can we make it right?
Almost 99.9% of the time, that's all it takes. And people are like, oh man, thanks, Sean. Like, right. And you seek to understand and listen and appreciate that I was upset about something. And it's like, cause we all make mistakes, and naturally we know other people are going to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And we just want them to say, hey, I'm sorry.
People are looking more to make sure that somebody else knows about their concern, their problem, their issue, what upset them, then they are really seeking a solution to it. You know, they just I want to be heard. I want to be heard. I hear you. You know,
that is so true.
I don't think I can go back and undo what mistake occurred, but I can try to correct. I try to resolve it in the following way, or do this for you. And I hope that works. But, you know, if they walk away, don't burn a bridge. You just say, listen, I'm sorry this didn't work out. I would have enjoyed doing business with you. I understand you're going to go in a different direction. That's fine. Well, let me just say, if that doesn't work out for you, if it doesn't meet your expectations, I'd always welcome an opportunity to meet with you again and discuss it further. You know, you get no benefit from saying, well, screw you, buddy. You know,
you're dead to me.
A better deal somewhere else. The hell with you. You know, take your money and take a hike. That gets you nothing. And you know, when I was consulting, there were many times where, you know, a company would go with the cheapest vendor, cheaper than the security firm I worked with and the services we were providing and the fees that we wanted. And invariably, they would be disappointed with the quality of what they got. And they'd come back. And they'd come back because we didn't burn the bridge. You know, we'd say, hey, listen, I hope this works out for you. The price structure you're getting is unbelievable, you know, and we just can't meet that, you know, with our margins and effort we have to put in it. But if you find that this is not doing what you want, I hope you'll consider you know, coming back and chatting with us and see if we can find a way to make this work together.
Perfect. Absolutely. It's in business, it happens all the time. Sure. In negotiation, we have deals all the time, and I tell people always, if you lose a deal and they go with somebody else, always let them know and say, hey, listen, you know, I loved your property. If this doesn't work out,
thanks for the opportunity to discuss it.
I'd love to talk about it again. And you'd be shocked at how many deals come back that went under contract that we lost that come back to us. And you would be shocked at how many times you tell somebody, hey, man, I'm really sorry. You know, the house wasn't clean. I was the last one that cleaned. I can't believe you walked into a dirty house, Gary. What can I do to solve that for you? And you 90% of the time people say, don't worry about it, Sean. It was not that big of a deal. It was, you know, it's not even something we worry about. And we always send them something nice anyway. But the minute you empathize with them and listen to them, we find many times they're just like, oh, don't even worry about it. You know, I appreciate you calling me back. Thanks for being responsive. And, you know,
I call it the restaurant example. You know, you're out to dinner with a group of six people and everybody's food comes, but one person's comes and it's cold. So it has to be sent back to the kitchen. Well, that just kind of ruined everybody's dinner because either five people have to wait for this food to come back out, or the other person will generally say, go ahead and eat. And then you all have to stare at them while they're eating. You know, and that's the case where the restaurant should say, you know what? We're terrible. Sorry for inconvenience. This person's meal or dessert is on the house, or, you know, whatever, a bottle of wine from the back. And if they do that, you'll come back. Yeah. You know, if they just say, oh, too bad, too sad, that's it. You're done with it, you know, and it costs them so little because people don't think about, well, you know, I'm going to handle this right, do the right thing. And it's probably going to mean I get future business from these people. And absolutely. If I don't handle it right, then they're gone. I get a bad review on Yelp or whatever the hell it is. And it's amazing how many times I've been in a restaurant and they do the wrong thing. It really is incredible. You know, and I would say if I run a restaurant, I would say, hey, if we've made a mistake, it's on us. Everybody gets a free dessert. I mean, whatever it is, who cares?
Right.
You know, don't screw it up for the long-term relationship.
Exactly. Because we're creatures of habit, right? We do come back. We actually go to the same restaurants on a regular basis. Yeah.
And everybody, I think, you know, there's some perhaps that don't because they're, you know, whatever their issues are. But most of us realize mistakes are made. You know, it's a rough night. The cook's got sick and they have a stand in. You know, things are tough. Fine. Just try to make it right. You know, and the manager's taking 25% off your. Great. Just do something. Some token of realization, acknowledgement that you didn't provide on this night the service that we expected. And I'll be back.
Yeah, love it. Love it. Awesome, man. Let's shift gears toward your book. I'd love to talk about the book. I know, you know, these conversations always fly by. I could sit and take, you know, hours of your time and just keep talking. And so I always appreciate it, but I always want to be respectful of it. But I want to make sure we can point people in the best direction to get more of this and read more of it. You've got a book, Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. And would love to point people that direction. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, I have a website, www.garynessner.com, where, you know, you can see the podcasts I've done and the articles I've written and, you know, some of the things I'm doing. But, you know, you can go, my book can be ordered on Amazon or any of the online book vendors, Barnes and Nobles, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's done quite well. It's funny, this week, it came out 15 years ago this week, and, you know, I'm very proud of it. It's done quite well. It's been, you know, it's a bestseller, and it's gotten, you know, critical acclaim, and it's, you know, it's a source of pride. They used it as a basis for the Paramount 2018 Waco movie, in which the twice Academy-nominated actor Michael Shannon played me. That was a fun project to be involved in. It was based partly on my book. So, you know, my book chronicles not only my personal journey in the FBI, but the evolution of negotiation in law enforcement and the shift we discussed earlier, Sean, about the movement from a bargaining, total bargaining orientation to a more of a crisis intervention model that is really the predominant model today. And, you know, I talk about so many of the big cases I was involved in, you know, Waco, Montana, flew down to Peru when the Japanese ambassador's residence was taken over by terrorists. I've been to several prison riots and skyjackings and kidnappings overseas. So it was an interesting career, and I learned a lot of valuable lessons from it that I've tried to incorporate within the book, and you know, particularly in the context of tips for negotiating in everyday life, and how this has broader applicability than some might realize.
Love it. And we'll put for those of you listening, you guys know, we put all of those links in the show notes so you can find it.
Appreciate it.
You know, get the book, and then Gary Nessner's website, and it's, and we'll have the right spelling, but it's Jarynoesner. And so it's, we'll make sure that that's in the link as well.
I've been called Nosner my whole life, but it's just a silent O. It's Nessner.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we'll make sure that they can just click a link, right? So they can go find out more. So, Gary, this has been awesome. I very, very much appreciate this conversation. I love these conversations. I always appreciate somebody being willing to let our listeners listen in. I know that they love these as much as I do because we get a lot of feedback. And so I always like to ask at the very end of every episode is, if you had to go back, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, the beginning of that career, is there anything that you would go back now that kind of an underlying principle or thought or guidance that you'd love to tell your younger self to, like, hey, listen, if I knew this, you know, what I know now, if I could have a little piece of advice for myself back then, what would it be?
Yeah, I think clearly it would be talk less and listen more. I mean, you know, I think even early in my negotiation career, I didn't listen anywhere near as well as I did, you know, toward the end of my career, you know, and you learn that when I'm talking, I'm not learning things that I need to know and understand in order to have an influence on you. So, you know, everybody can practice in life, you know, whether it's with your family or friends, you know, when you ask them, you know, how was your vacation? Don't just then rush into telling them about your vacation. You know, ask them follow-up questions. Well, what did you like about that? You know, what was the biggest challenge you faced? And would you go back again? And people like to talk about those experiences, you know. And, you know, at the end of the day, they'll say, I really enjoyed talking to Gary today about that, you know, that trip we just went on. He seemed really interested in it and, you know, whatever. And it's not phony. It's not... it should be done sincerely, obviously, and not in a manipulative way, but do it genuinely and sincerely. And it makes you a likable person because you're willing to understand others and appreciate what they're dealing with, what they've gone through, what their hopes and dreams and aspirations are. And it makes you an invaluable friend, certainly a trusted contact. And that's all good stuff. So I would say, you know, and I just leave you with one thing. I spoke at a university in Boston some years ago, and it was all students, male and female. And I said, you know, guys, I had fun in college, but I wish I had known some of this in terms of dating young ladies, you know, because typically men are kind of brag about the car they drive, the sports they play, the cool guys they hang out with, and the neat stuff that they do. You know, I said, just shut up and ask her questions about her life, her hobbies, her interests, what she enjoys. And you'd be amazed at how impactful that is for you know, someone that you're interested in creating a relationship with. And, you know, you'll be more successful in those relationships you're trying to build.
Love it. So all you single guys listening, talk less, listen more. Yeah. And so straight from Gary. So we'll, I love that. That's awesome. Well, I appreciate it. Yeah. That's been great, Gary. I appreciate you joining us. Those of you who are listening, I know how much you like these episodes. We appreciate you spending your time with us. We know how valuable it is and very much appreciate it. If you got any value out of these conversations and you know somebody else that would, our goal is to help you walk into the life of investing in vacation rentals and having great conversations like this, you know, with your eyes wide open. And if you know somebody else that would like these conversations, share the show. Those things help us. I don't run ads and sponsorships or anything else on the show. Our growth is all organic from you guys sharing it. And if you have more than 30 seconds, liking it and reviewing it on whatever platform you're watching or listening on. And the final, most important thing I ask you guys at the end of every episode is pick that one thing you can do today, start building that life you don't want to take a vacation from. Cheers, my friends.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution podcast. Share this with other people you think need to hear about it. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Hey, Grace, is there a website? Yes! For more amazing content and expert advice, visit Odyssey.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.